25th, 2016. Okay, so we'll start with the homage to the Buddha three times. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. So today we come to sutta number 43 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Mahavedala Sutta. And in the title, the exact meaning of the word Vedala is really not understood well. So when we give it the English title, The Greatest Series of Questions and Answers, that's based more on the actual content or form or structure of the sutta rather than as an attempt to translate the word Vedala. And we know, well, we could see that there are two Vedala suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the greater or longer one, and we had already done the shorter Mahavedala Sutta. But it seems to me that there are some, let us say that there could have been some overlapping or confusion even in the assignment of certain portions to one Vedala rather than the other Vedala Sutta. So in the Mahavedala Sutta, the greater series, there is a section with a discussion of what is called the meditative attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling. But it seems that part of the explanation of that attainment is missing from the Maha version. And we find it in the shorter version. So it seems probably or perhaps originally that shorter portion, or that portion on the cessation of perception and feeling that's now in the shorter version, was originally in the longer version. Or maybe all of it was in the shorter version, but that would have made the shorter version bigger than the than the longer version. So their names would have had to be changed. Anyway, when we come to that section in the Mahavedala Sutta, we'll probably also have to refer back to the shorter Vedala Sutta, which we had discussed maybe 2 or 3 years ago. So unless everybody's memory, recollection of that sutta is very clear, it would be useful to go back and look at it. But we won't get to that this week. Okay, both of these Vedala suttas, the way I look at them, seem to be what I would call, or to represent, a transitional phase in which the early Buddha's teaching, as we find in, you know, discourses in the Sanyutta Nikaya and Guttara Nikaya, most of the Majjhima Nikaya, is moving in the direction that will culminate in the Abhidhamma. In fact, we find the expression Abhidhamma, as it's used in the suttas, is referring not to a distinct body of text or literature corresponding to the Abhidhamma Pitaka, but when the text uses the word Abhidhamma, it's always referring to discussions amongst the monks. So it seems originally the word Abhidhamma had the meaning of a discussion about the Dhamma, in which the Dhamma is being treated somewhat with greater technical detail and precision than we find in the general discourses of the Buddha. And so this Mahavedala Sutta, as we'll see, illustrates that characteristic of being a discussion between monks about the Dhamma and dealing with fine, subtle, technical points that we don't find in, you know, the usual discourses of the Buddha himself. And so this discourse takes place as a discussion between the Venerable Sariputta and the Venerable Mahakotita. The Venerable Sariputta, of course, is known as the chief disciple of the Buddha, and the disciple whose specialization was panya, or wisdom. And historically, through many traditions of early Buddhism, Sariputta is connected with the foundations of the Abhidhamma. So we can't believe that the Abhidhamma texts that we have now were actually written or composed by Sariputta, but it's quite possible that Sariputta started this tradition of taking the statements of the Buddha and then explaining them in this very detailed, analytical manner. And then as Sariputta's own pupils learned the method of rigorous analysis from Sariputta, they would have started to apply that method to a larger and larger body of material until these discussions amongst them eventually crystallized in the formation of texts that came to be called Abhidharma texts. And the other monk involved in this discussion is named Mahakotita. And often we find Mahakotita engaged in discussions with Sariputta, usually on subtle points of Dharma. And the Buddha declared Mahakotita to be the foremost disciple in regard to a certain branch of learning that is called the analytical knowledges. In Pali, the word is Pratisambiddha. And so there are said to be four Pratisambiddha, four analytical knowledges. One is the analytical knowledge of the meaning. A word, atta, which also is explained as having the meaning of results or fruits. Results or fruits. Fruits in the sense of the effects or consequences, not analytical knowledge of different types of apples, grapes, oranges, dragon fruits. So we have analytical knowledge of atta, which means meaning or results. Then there's Dhamma Pratisambiddha, which is the analytical knowledge of the doctrine. That's Dhamma as doctrine. But the commentaries also explain Dhamma here as causes. So these first two analytical knowledges go together. Analytical knowledge of effects, analytical knowledge of causes. Analytical knowledge of meanings, analytical knowledge of dhammas or doctrines. Okay, then the third analytical knowledge is analytical knowledge of terminology. That is, knowing and understanding the right terms and expressions to use when expounding the Dhamma. And then the fourth analytical knowledge is the analytical knowledge. It's hard to find the suitable English word to represent this, to translate this. The word is patibbana. The meaning seems to be, well, I've been using the rendering for this ingenuity. And the way it's explained, it is the ability to use the three former types of knowledge, the knowledge of meanings, the knowledge of doctrines, the knowledge of terminology, to be able to utilize those three in order to expound and explain the Dhamma. So you could see that this analytical knowledge goes very closely with the type of enterprise that's undertaken in the Abhidhamma, in which concepts are taken, precisely defined, and then all of their implications are drawn out and woven together. Okay, and the disciple of the Buddha who is said to have excelled in that sphere of competence was Mahakotita. And it's these two monks that participate in the discussion that makes up the Mahavedala Sutta. Okay, so let us now go to the sutta itself. So the sutta takes place first. It mentions that at the time the Buddha was dwelling in Savatthi at the Natapindika's monastery. Okay, so then one evening the Venerable Mahakotita came out from his meditation and went to the Venerable Sariputta, and they exchanged greetings. And then he sat down, and then he spoke to the Venerable Sariputta. And he asked a question, but we have to understand, when Mahakotita is asking questions to Venerable Sariputta, it's not that he doesn't know the answers himself, but he's asking these questions in order to draw out answers from somebody who is like a master of the doctrine, like Sariputta, probably to find out simply how Sariputta would answer these questions, and perhaps also with the idea that this discourse will be remembered and then transmitted to his own disciples so they could learn the explanations given by Sariputta. Okay, so first he comes to Sariputta and he says, one who is dupanyo, which is translated here, unwise, one who is unwise, with reference to what is this said, one who is unwise. And the word translated here, unwise, is dupanya. Yeah, the word panya is the adjective form based on panya, which means wisdom. And the prefix dur sometimes means bad, sometimes uncomfortable, like the word dukkha, suffering. Okay, so this is somebody without wisdom. We might even say foolish or even stupid for dupanya. But here, politely, it's translated as unwise. Okay, so then Sariputta answers and he says, one does not... The actual Pali would be rendered, one does not understand, one does not understand. And so the Pali, sorry to be putting so much Pali in. You see, we come to a certain problem in translation. Okay, there's a noun, panya, which we translate as wisdom. And this is explained on the basis of the verb pajanati. And this verb, it's based on the root, the Pali root, nya, which in Sanskrit is jnā, jnā, which means to know. And it occurs in many verbs in relating to different types of knowledge. Okay, so when we have pajanāti, it has the prefix pa plus the verb janāti. And so we translate this as to understand. But the verb pajanati is the basis for the noun panya, which we translate as wisdom. And so we have a disconnect between in English between the verb and the noun, whereas in the original language, in Pali, that connection is immediately apparent. If we translate panya as understanding, then it seems to be like a very ordinary, mundane quality. Like he has an understanding of biology, he has an understanding of economics. No, I'm mistaken about that. Nobody has an understanding of economics. he has an understanding of computer programming. Whereas panya in Buddhism means a higher type of understanding, you know, penetrative spiritual understanding of spiritual truths. And so to render the verb, I don't know, maybe you could say he wisens up. To wisen. But that sounds a little strange. We don't speak that way often. So that's why in translation, I don't remember whether it was Venerable Nyanamoli or myself. I think it was I did this myself. We put the adverb wisely in front of understand to make the connection with panya, wisdom. So in this case, it's the negation. One does not wisely understand. One does not wisely understand. That is why it is said, one who is unwise. And what doesn't one wisely understand? One does not wisely understand. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Okay, so we start off with the negative side, with the absence of panya, the absence of wise understanding or wisdom. Okay, now, next we come to the positive side, where we're dealing with the question of who is wise and how is one wise. And so here the question, the Mahakotita brings up the question. First he says, one who is wise, one who is wise. So here the adjective is panyava. So the suffix va means one who has, one who possesses, and what is possessed is panya, wisdom. So one who possesses wisdom is called wise. Okay, so the question is, with reference to what is it said, panyava, one who has wisdom, one who is wise? And then the answer comes, pajana, in Pali it's simply pajanati, pajanati, which is translated here, one wisely understands, one wisely understands. That is why it is said, one who is wise. And what does one wisely understand? Again, the answer is, in terms of the Four Noble Truths, one wisely understands this is suffering, this is its origin, this is its cessation, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And so when it is said, one wisely, when it is said, one who is wise, that is said with reference to one who wisely understands. Okay, so this little exchange shows us the sphere of wisdom according to early Buddhism. So the sphere or domain of wisdom is the Four Noble Truths. And according to the commentary, sometimes, as I've said before, I don't completely go along with the commentaries. So the commentary here says that one who possesses wisdom in this sense is one starting from the person on the stage of the path of stream entry up to the stage of, I think it's one on the path to arahatship. No, it just says that the lowest type of person to be described as wise is the person on the path of stream entry. So it would go from the person on the path of stream entry up to and including the arahat. And I think this is said on the basis of a number of passages which speak about the stream enterer, or one on the path of stream entry, as one who gains the eye of Dharma, or who makes the breakthrough to the Dhamma. And what one sees when one gains the eye of Dhamma, what one penetrates to or breaks through to, is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. So up until the time one reaches the path of stream entry, we can have an intellectual or conceptual knowledge of the Four Noble Truths, but we don't actually have the panya or wisdom of the Four Noble Truths. Even when we are doing insight meditation, vipassana meditation, we'll be gaining some understanding of the truth of dukkha, because we can see impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, non-self to some extent. We can see how craving is bringing about dukkha, suffering or discontent, unsatisfactoriness. But one doesn't have what I would call the global or comprehensive Four Noble knowledge of the Four Noble Truths until one reaches the path of stream entry. Of course, it's at the path of stream entry that the mind turns away from all conditioned phenomena and actually sees and experiences Nibbana, which is the cessation of suffering, the third noble truth. And it's when one sees the actual cessation of suffering that one can then look back at all conditioned phenomena, everything included in the five aggregates, and understand all this is really dukkha, bound up with suffering and unsatisfactoriness. Okay, so it's when one understands in this global or comprehensive way the Four Noble Truths that one can be said or called wise. That's according to the commentarial explanation. But I think, as I said, sometimes the commentary is being too restrictive, and maybe we could say one who even has a conceptual, a correct and accurate conceptual knowledge of the Four Noble Truths that can be called wise in a broad sense. Okay, now we move into the next section of the sutta. And here the question is brought up, but first it said, consciousness, consciousness, it is said, friend, with reference to what is consciousness said. Okay, now when we look at this in English translation, it looks like a completely different topic from the topic of wisdom. But if one knows, if one is reading in Pali, or even if one knows Pali terminology, we can see that the relationship between these two sections is actually fairly close, because the noun that's rendered consciousness in Pali and the verb on which consciousness, vijnana, is based is vijanati. So you could see between panya and vijnana, they're both formed on the basis of the same verbal root, this jna or jna, and the verbs look very close. The difference is simply pujanati, which is one understands the basis for panya, wisdom. And here the verb is vijanati. We could say one cognizes, and that's the basis for wisdom, for vijnana, rendered consciousness. And so Mahakotita is trying to find out the distinction between these two words, which very different in English, wisdom and consciousness, but in Pali, very close together, panya, pajanati, and vijnana, vijanati. So it's almost like a fine hair's verbally, just a fine hair distinction between them. Okay, so Sariputta gives the answer, it cognizes vijanati, vijanati. That is why consciousness is said. And then he goes on, and this seems somewhat strange to me. He says, what does it cognize? It cognizes pleasant. It cognizes painful. It cognizes neither painful nor pleasant. So it cognizes. That is why consciousness is said. I find this a little bit puzzling and perplexing, because it would seem that if you're going to say, what does consciousness cognize, to answer just in terms of feeling seems very limited. And I checked on my friend Venerable Anallio. He has this very big book called The Comparative Study Between the Suttas of the Majjhima Nikaya and their counterparts or parallels from other early Buddhist traditions. And so he did a comparison between this sutta and the Chinese translation, Madhyama Agama version of the sutta. And in the Madhyama Agama version of the sutta, it says, what does consciousness cognize? Then it gives the six sense objects, which makes better sense to me, that it cognizes visible forms, sounds, odors, flavors, tactile objects, and mental objects. Because in many other suttas, when the question is raised, what is consciousness, then the answer is given that there are these six types of consciousness: eye consciousness, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind consciousness. So we have six types of consciousness. Each type of consciousness has its own distinctive object. And so the answer, what does it cognize, of what is consciousness conscious, the reasonable answer seems to be that the six types of sense objects. Yeah, failing will be brought in. Yeah. Okay, maybe so. Or maybe it was the influence of the next section that sort of impacted on this section and led to that answer rather than the six sense objects. Anyway, let us continue. Okay, now we get into a rather subtle part of the discussion, really sort of moving very much in the direction of Abhidhamma. Okay, so here we have the question is raised, wisdom and consciousness, friend, are these states conjoined, that's joined together, associated, or disjoined, utterly separate? And is it possible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them? Okay, so those are the questions. Then Sariputta answers, wisdom and consciousness, friend, these states, and he's using the word Dhamma in that plural sense of mental factors. Wisdom and consciousness, friend, these states are conjoined, not disjoined, and it is impossible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them. Okay, this doesn't mean that there is no difference between them. as we'll see, there is a difference between them. The two have different functions, different characteristics and different functions. But in order to describe the difference between them, you can't pull them apart and say, this is wisdom, this is consciousness. Wisdom occurs here, consciousness occurs here. They're always associated. And there's a later Pali work called the Milinda Panha, the questions of the King Milinda, in which it's an imaginary dialogue between a Greek king, or king of Greek descent, ruling over Bactria, Gandhara, that's now Pakistan, and the Buddhist monk Nagasena, in which the monk Nagasena, he's explaining how the Buddha was able to distinguish different mental factors which are joined together. And he compares this to the way that different mental factors are joined together to a soup which is made with using different spices, or maybe like an Indian curry which is made with turmeric, cumin, chili powders, mustard seed. What are some of the other spices? Masala. Is masala a distinct spice? Fenugreek. Yeah, okay, you have all of these different spices and used to flavor the curry sauce. And so when we eat or taste the curry sauce, you know, it's very difficult to distinguish this part of the taste of the curry sauce is due to the cumin, this part is due to the turmeric, this part, well, you could tell what's coming from the chili pepper. This is due to the fenugreek, this is due to the masala. Because they're all blended together, but maybe a very experienced cook tasting the curry sauce can tell this much is due to the fenugreek, this much is due to the cumin powder, and he'll know to get the ideal sauce how much more cumin you have to use or how much more turmeric. And so what the Buddha has done in analyzing these different mental states that occur conjoined is similar to distinguishing the different spices used to prepare a curry sauce. Okay, so Sariputta says, wisdom and consciousness are conjoined, not disjoined, and it's impossible to separate them in order to describe the difference between them. Then he says, for what one wisely understands, that one cognizes. Whenever there is understanding or wisdom, there's also consciousness present. And what one cognizes, that one wisely understands. This has to be taken in the sense that when there's an experience of wisdom occurring, then when one is conscious of that, cognizing it, then wisdom is also present. It doesn't mean that whenever one is conscious, then one has wisdom. In that case, everybody in the world who's except those in a deep coma, we would say have wisdom. And since they have wisdom, and wisdom understands the Four Noble Truths, it means everybody understands the Four Noble Truths. In that case, I could turn off my computer, finish my drink, pack my bag, and go back to my room. And since I'll be a little tired from cognizing the Four Noble Truths all the time, I could go to sleep, fade out from consciousness. And then as soon as I wake up again, then I'll be knowing and penetrating the Four Noble Truths. So you shouldn't take it to mean that whenever one is conscious, one has wisdom, but rather it's saying in an experience of wisdom, in an experience where wisdom is present, then consciousness, one is cognizing that which one is understanding. Okay, so that's, so then he concludes, that is why these states are conjoined, not disjoined, and it is impossible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them. So if you just read this superficially, you might think that he's saying that there is no difference between wisdom and consciousness. But then Mahakotita raises the next question, which shows that there is a difference between them. He says, what is the difference between wisdom and consciousness? These states that are conjoined, not disjoined. And then Sariputta answers, the difference between wisdom and consciousness is this. Wisdom is to be developed, and consciousness is to be fully understood. I guess this is self-evident. No? What? No, I'm only joking when I say that. Yeah, this is a bit obscure. And so to understand this, we have to, I think, relate it to a particular structure that the Buddha develops in regard to the Four Noble Truths. You see, we're getting quite technical here. And that is why I didn't take this sutta as we were going through the Majjhima Nikaya in sequence, but I kept it. In fact, I wasn't going to take this at all, thinking it was too technical. But then, I don't even see her here. It was Suki Park, and Carolyn Cronin said, take it, take it, take it. So I said, okay. Okay, so regarding these four truths, and we find this even in the first sermon of the Buddha, when he first explained the Four Noble Truths, he didn't just declare or announce the Four Noble Truths, but if you look at the whole discourse, he says with regard to each truth, there is a particular function or task that has to be fulfilled. So regarding dukkha, the task is full understanding, to fully understand it. And what is the truth of dukkha? What does it, when you reduce it to its simplest, most basic terms, what does it come down to? The five aggregates, right. And the origin, what is the origin of dukkha, according to the first sermon? Right, it's craving. And so what is the function regarding the first, the second noble truth? Right, to abandon it. And then the cessation of dukkha, what does it really amount to, ultimately? Right, it's nibbana. And then what is the function regarding that? Right, to realize it, to attain it, to experience it. And then the path, of course, is the Noble Eightfold Path. And what is the function regarding the path? Right, exactly. To develop it. Okay, so the statement that we have in the sutta here, the way I see it, has to be interpreted in terms of this particular, call it a template, in that consciousness, where does consciousness fit in relation to the Four Noble Truths? Exactly. It fits in number one because consciousness is one of the five aggregates, the fifth aggregate. And so because the five aggregates should be fully understood, and consciousness is one of the five aggregates, so consciousness should be fully understood. Okay, now in terms of this diagram or template, where does wisdom fit in? This is getting a little technical. Right, wisdom, and where in four does it fit in? Exactly. Now we have a modern Mahakotita amongst us. Right. So wisdom is, in a way, synonymous with the path factor of right view. And so, since the Noble Eightfold Path is to be developed, this means that right view, of course, is to be developed, and punya, wisdom, is a kind of synonym of the higher right view. And so when one is developing the Noble Eightfold Path, one is developing wisdom. And when one is developing wisdom, wisdom is what will understand the five aggregates, and wisdom will understand consciousness. Okay, maybe at this point we'll pause and see if there are any questions. Does anybody feel that their head is exploding because of all of these technical... Okay, somebody had some question?
So, you said wisdom will understand consciousness. Are you saying they are separate? So the consciousness fits into the number one dukkha, but how about number two and number three? Consciousness is not there, does not exist in understanding the craving, not understand how to abandon it, how understand is realizing it. The consciousness does not use... We don't use consciousness in number two and number three. When you just said, I misunderstood. I just want to know the wisdom fits in relation to the four tasks. You're talking about wisdom in the path, in that number four path.
Yeah.
And number one, dukkha, is the consciousness. And how about
dukkha? I don't say that dukkha is equivalent to consciousness. What I said is that consciousness is one of the five aggregates, and the sutta explains dukkha, what we translate suffering, is ultimately the five aggregates. And so the five aggregates are to be understood, to be fully understood.
Yes, and that is, I'm sorry, maybe I just simplifies my question. So in other words, to understand dukkha fully, fully understand the dukkha from five aggregates, so that is a consciousness is related to that first function in fully understand dukkha.
Yeah.
My question is consciousness being utilized at number two, understanding the craving to abandon, whether it's used in this third path, third sensation of realizing nirvana. Yeah. That's what my question is. Whether dichotomously separated.
I think I understand your question. Wisdom, as the sutta itself says, wisdom and consciousness are always conjoined, so they can't be separated. So when wisdom is being used to understand the first noble truth, consciousness is always present along with that wisdom. When one is abandoning craving, consciousness is present in that act of abandoning craving. When one is realizing nibbana, since it's a conscious experience, consciousness is present. So consciousness is present all through, all the functions regarding the Four Noble Truths. It's just that in terms of this particular task in regard to consciousness and wisdom, the task regarding consciousness is to fully understand it. The task regarding wisdom is to develop it. Does that make it clear?
Another favor. The last sentence, when you said, in the sutra, it says, wisdom is to be developed, consciousness is to be fully understood. Do you think it's possible for you to give us the four sentences in Pali? Sorry.
I didn't actually bring the Pali text with me. Let me just see if I could reconstruct it. Let me look. Maybe I had it in the note. No, I just had the explanation in the note.
Bhante, you don't need to give it to us right away. I just want to know the words being used, Pali words being used, when you said developed, and understood.
Oh, that's easy to do.
Yeah. I'd like to know the distinction in these two words in Pali.
Okay. So the difference is between developed, or let's say fully understood. Can you see? Maybe better to write on the top. And developed is bhavetabha. Okay, the word parinyaya, fully understood, again, is based on these verbal roots, nya, with Sanskrit, nya, except that it has the prefix pari, which gives a sense of fullness. In fact, full understanding, you can see this more clearly, is parinya. Just as panya is the same base, just a different prefix. Whereas bhavetabha, it's related to the noun bhavana. Bhavana is what sometimes we call it meditation. So we say vipassana bhavana is insight meditation. But bhavana actually means development or cultivation. It's based on the verb bhaveti, which means to bring into being. So wisdom is something that we have to literally bring into being. And then once it comes into being, then we have to cultivate it further until it becomes parinya, full understanding. You see, there's so much that's so many like connections between words in the Pali text that are clear in the original language, but when you read translation, those connections are cut because the English language, it's hard to match. Yeah, it's hard to match word for word in the same way. Okay, Stephen, take the microphone.
Bhante, would it be correct to say or think that of it this way, that consciousness cannot be developed, that it's sort of more of a biological function, and so that when we move from just this functioning of the brain as consciousness to more understanding of what we're observing, then that moves to wisdom, towards wisdom?
That moves what?
Towards wisdom, when we actually start moving beyond merely observing the biological function of consciousness towards a deeper understanding of what we're perceiving.
Yeah, I think one could express it that way.
Okay. Thank you.
Though I'd say that, maybe this is my own way of formulating that. This, but when we're developing wisdom in a way, we're developing our consciousness as well, since consciousness then becomes capable of wiser functions or wiser activity.
But I would think that consciousness is more of like a camera type of, you know, something that you can't really make better. You could just look at it.
I'd say that maybe the basic sensory functions of consciousness are somewhat like a camera. But maybe the higher mental functions, consciousness within the, as involved in the higher mental functions, is something that can be developed.
Okay.
But the texts don't express it that way, but they express in terms of, you know, using this template of the Four Noble Truths. In that case, wisdom is to be developed. And then because consciousness is associated with wisdom, so when one is developing wisdom, then the consciousness that's conjoined with wisdom will also be developed. Okay, shall we move on then? Okay, now we come to the next section. So now we're bringing in another mental function. This is feeling, vedana, in Pali, vedana. Okay, so now the question is raised, the topic is brought up. Feeling is said, friend, with reference to what is feeling said. Okay, so then the answer is given, again, in terms of a verb. Here we put in the pronoun, it feels, but in Pali it's simply vedeti, vedeti. Just the verb is used. You know, it's hard to express it without putting in a pronoun. So it's a little bit like when we say, it's raining. You know, but what is the it that is raining? It's just the rain is falling. So this is, feeling is occurring, and we say it feels, it feels. That is why feeling is said. Then what does it feel? So it feels pleasure, it feels pain, it feels neither pain nor pleasure. So those are the three basic types or tones of feeling. Okay, then we come to the next section. Okay, so here we have perception, now the next topic is perception. And so the question is brought up, with reference to what is this word perception used? Okay, then the answer is given, it perceives, or simply in Pali, it's sanjanati, sanjanati, perceives, perceives. That is why perception is said. And now this word perception, again you'll see, I'll take this out. You can see that the noun sanya is also based on this root nya. So it's also involved with knowing in some way, except it just has a different prefix. And then you can see even more clearly in the verb sanjanati. So again, it revolves around knowing. In a way. But it's seems a more primitive type of knowing, certainly than panya or wisdom, and even than consciousness. Okay, so the question is raised, what does it perceive? And then it just chose, for some reason, it just chooses one particular sense modality, namely sight. So it perceives blue, it perceives yellow, it perceives red, and it perceives white. So it perceives, that is why perception is said. Okay, so if you just look at the answer and take it very literally, you think perception is always involved with sight. But in fact, perception takes the objects of all of the six senses. So one perceives visible forms, one perceives sounds, perceives odors, flavors, tastes, tactile sensations. And now the question might be raised, it's not actually raised in the sutta, but I would raise it, and it often comes up in discussions, what is the difference between consciousness, vijnana, and perception, sanya? Because they seem very, very close they're closely associated, and their functions seem very close together. And I don't find a clear answer in the suttas themselves, but this is the way I answer that question to myself. Okay, usually, excuse me. Okay, usually when consciousness is being distinguished, it's divided in terms of the sense faculties on the basis of which it arises. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, mind consciousness. Whereas when perception is being analyzed or distinguished, it's distinguished in terms of the object, perception of forms, perception of sounds, and so on. So I, in my way of thinking, I explain the difference in this way, that consciousness is, maybe you can call it the bare awareness or the light of awareness that arises based on a particular sense faculty, and that opens up the entire domain of objects corresponding to that sense faculty. So eye consciousness, it's consciousness arising based on the eye, and it opens up the entire domain of visible forms to my awareness. Ear consciousness arises based on the ear, and it opens up the whole domain of sounds to my awareness, and so for the other sense types of sense consciousness. Perception, on the other hand, has the function of homing in on particular objects within that broad domain in order to label them, designate them, recognize them, pick out their distinguishing marks. Okay, so to give an example, so eye consciousness opens up for me right now this entire domain of everything within the sphere of my field of vision. It opens up the whole field of vision and makes that available to me. But it's perception that maybe picks up, this is a flask, which it's on the table, so I know that it contains some kind of, or I assume it contains some kind of tea. And then perception will identify, okay, that this is the flask intended for me because it has a gray background with dark gray bands on it. Is it a light blue? Well, and with the lighting, it's a little difficult to distinguish whether it's gray or blue. Okay, then it's tongue consciousness opens up the entire domain of taste to me. But right now I'm not tasting anything particular, but if I sip this, then I know that this is some kind of berry tea. Guji berry? So I never drank guji berry tea before, though I've eaten guji berries. So now if I am given this in the future, then through perception, then I'll be able to recognize and identify, that's guji berry tea. Well, maybe you gave it to me in the past. No. And I forgot, and so a new perception. Anyway, so that's my understanding of the relation between perception and consciousness. Okay, now another question comes up, and that is, it says, feeling, perception, and consciousness, are these states, these dhammas, conjoined or disjoined? And is it possible to separate each of these states from the others in order to describe the difference between them? Okay, so now Sariputta answers and says, he explains, feeling, perception, and consciousness, friend, these states are conjoined, not disjoined, and it is impossible to separate each from the others in order to describe the difference between them. And so with this, we're getting very, very close to the emergence of the ideas of, in the Abhidhamma, of what we call a citta, a state of consciousness, which is made up of a bunch or a bundle of mental factors, chaitasikas. Okay, so then Sariputta answers and he says, feeling, perception, and consciousness, friend, these states are conjoined, not disjoined, and it is impossible to separate each from the others in order to describe the difference between them. For what one feels, that one perceives, and what one perceives, that one cognizes. That is why these states are conjoined, not disjoined. And it is impossible to separate each from the others in order to describe the difference between them. Okay, so what this is saying is that whenever one feels something, well, let's put it this way. I prefer maybe to start with consciousness. So with consciousness, one cognizes something. So something comes within the sphere or domain of awareness. And then as one cognizes it, as one is aware of it, then one perceives it, which means one identifies it, one designates it, one recognizes it, one labels it in some way. And along with that cognition, and along with that perception, there comes some feeling tone. If one is, for example, seeing something agreeable and pleasant, then there will arise a pleasant feeling. If one is seeing something which is disagreeable, something irritating or annoying, or threatening, then there'll come a painful feeling. And if one is cognizing something just neutral, not particularly pleasant, not particularly painful, then there'll arise the feeling neither painful nor pleasant. Okay, so here we have feeling, perception, consciousness. And in the Chinese version, which is translated from a kind of Sanskrit, there's also a little section on intention. The Chinese character is su, which it renders in Pali chaitana, volition or intention. And so when we have feeling, perception, and intention along with consciousness, what do we have there? Those four factors, what do they represent? They do, but it's not the answer that I was looking for. Well, we could say Chaitanya represents volitional formations, and now we have perception, feeling, volitional formations, consciousness. What do we have there? Yeah, it's exactly, it's on the right track. What we have are the four mental aggregates that go along with physical form. So feeling, perception, volition, or intention representing volitional formations, and consciousness. So the four mental aggregates. So these four always occur together. So whenever there's consciousness, there is some feeling of the object, a perception of the object, some intention, even a slight one, regarding the object. And what is meant when it's, according to the commentary, when it's said that these states are conjoined, it means that they have a common arising, they all arise together. They have a common cessation, they all come to an end together. They all share the same object, and they arise based on the same sense base. And so when I see the flask, okay, it seems to me, you know, if I look at it with the gross kind of awareness, okay, that first I'm perceiving the flask, then if I recognize, this is a flask with Guji berry tea, and I like it, then a pleasant feeling will arise, and then I'll have a volition or an intention to take the flask and pour out the tea. That's the way it appears, let's say, to our ordinary sort of gross level consciousness. But according to the sort of very precise way of understanding the mind that we find in the Buddhist psychology, on any occasion of consciousness, there is always some feeling, some perception, some volition. So even when I first catch sight of the flask, some feeling will be present. If I'm not clearly aware of it, but just marginally aware of it, then it'll be a neutral feeling. There'll be some intention regarding the flask, even if it's just the intention of not doing anything about it. Okay, so those states, they arise together, they cease together, in one moment of consciousness, a moment of consciousness that goes by like that. They have the same object, and they arise on the same sense basis, either the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body sensitivity, or the mind. Okay, maybe I'll ask whether there's any questions. I'm afraid to go into the next section. I will drive people insane. Okay, young man in the back. Make sure it's on.
Okay, so when you're perceiving something, you don't want to be on the positive or negative end of perception, right? Is it better to be in the neutral portion when you are perceiving an object or a being or anything?
Say again, I didn't quite catch it.
Is it better to be neutral when you are perceiving objects as opposed to a positive or a negative aspect of something in order to avoid suffering or desire?
I'd say that this depends very much on the particular situation, that there's no simple answer to that. Sometimes people think that the ideal of Buddhism is just to be neutral under all conditions, not reactive either towards the pleasant or to the painful. But what I would say is that this maybe is an oversimplification and misrepresentation, since the ideal would be to move towards those things that enable wholesome mental qualities to arise and that that help one to abandon, to eliminate, or to reduce unwholesome mental qualities. Oh, that's the lunch bell. I'm sorry. Okay, so suppose like I hear announcement that there's going to be a Dhamma talk given in such and such a place or a meditation course, something, and I'm completely neutral towards it, then I don't go to the to hear the Dhamma talk or to the meditation course. So I'm not taking advantage of that opportunity to, you know, to cultivate the mind. If I'm being attacked by we don't have elephants here. We don't have tigers here. What do we have? A bear. Okay, here we have a bear or a poisonous snake. If I don't move or get out of the way and think, just be neutral. Yeah, then I'll become a nice supper for some animal. Well, I don't think bears will eat a human being. They'll just batter them. Yeah, so you have to, you know, assess the situation. In fact, even the Buddha says in Sutta number 2, he says that reflecting wisely, one avoids, he says, a wild elephant, a wild horse, a wild, a vicious dog. Okay, maybe we'll leave other questions since this time is going by. We'll do the sharing of the merits now, and then we'll come back, say 12:15. We can have a discussion, our own question and answer session. And next week, we won't have a class because we have the annual summer camp here. So the next class will be July 10th, is it? Wow, time goes so quickly, doesn't it? That's right, July 9th, 10th, 17th, 24th, 23rd, 16th. Right, July 9th. Okay, so let us do the sharing of the merits. So we share the merits with the devas, the nagas or dragon spirits, the buddhas, the fair spirits, and with all beings. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Eta vatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu. Sabba sampati siddhya etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadaya avichihetato Etantare satakayupapana rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibhuting. Okay, so we stand and we do three half bows.